Hey now, it's Mike Gilbert, host of the Mike and JD Show, right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Join JD by God Oliva and myself every Thursday night live on the Voices of Wrestling YouTube channel at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time as we stay up all night discussing all the hottest stories in professional wrestling. You can also check us out right here on the Voices of Wrestling podcasting feed, or you can subscribe to the Mike and JD Show feed. Now, enjoy the show.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling podcasting network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day, over the rainbow, gotta let it go. So far, fast to freedom, stars tonight.
Welcome back to Open the Voice Gate for May 13th, 2025. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find us on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network feed or on our own dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed on all podcast platforms and applications. You can follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate. If you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site. You click the red boxes to sponsor this podcast, and you can set up a one-time or reoccurring donation. No obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank all of our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, Mike Spears, joined alongside, as always, your other host, Case Lowe. And Case, how are you doing this Tuesday?
I'm okay. You know, I don't have any grandiose story. I don't have an NBA update other than that we are sitting here watching the Pacers play the Cavs in game 5 of the series, with the Pacers up 3-1, so they can move on to the Eastern Conference Finals for the second year in a row. If they win tonight, which is a tough start for the Pacers, but hey, long game, you know, they've come back before, but I've got nothing big going on. Mike, how are you?
Well, I think I managed to put out all of our major fires right now for at least Open the Voice Gate. So we're good right now. If this was at about 4:50 PM, just an hour and a half before this, it would have been just absolute profanities and curses, but we're good. Guess what I have on the TV ahead of me?
I don't know. Is it just an ongoing loop of the Dallas Mavericks winning the NBA lottery?
I mean, it was weird that when I heard about that case yesterday, I was like, oh, yeah, no, that makes sense. And then I just was like, I wonder if this means that Nico Harrison gets another way to like have like an indefensible move here, because like it wasn't there like manufactured like media about how they saying the Mavericks should trade the pick for Giannis. Wasn't that like one of the things that came out of that?
Well, there was the Giannis report yesterday that came out that people interpreted as he's asking for a trade, but the Shams quote was Giannis is open-minded about the idea of a trade, which means that he didn't ask for a trade, nothing happened, he's merely open-minded about a hypothetical situation. And that leads to, okay, well, what is he worth? Is he worth the first overall pick? And I think that discussion had there. I wouldn't say that was a widespread discussion, but I did see a little bit of that.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that I feel like that someday Mark Stein or Tim Cato is going to, like, a year from now, going to, like, come out with a book that's going to be like this Jake Tapper, Joe Biden book, basically. That's going to be like, oh yeah, no, Nico Harrison just did X, Y, and Z, and everyone was just looking at everyone like, what is he doing about this? And I don't know. It's such a, like, a bizarre just situation for me that I did not feel a single thing when that first overall pick was announced. But Case, actually, what I have on the TV in front of me is from Tomomo Kai in Hokkaido, the Great T-Hawk House Show, and I have Takahiro Yamamura, who I might have to be talking my way into him on my 30 for 30, to be quite honest at this point. and JD Lee versus the Tokyo Bad Boys, who are not coming close to my 30 under 30 by like a 10-foot, by like a 10-mile range, you know. But interesting crowd here. It's the DGUSA connotation, I would say. Do you remember the DGUSA show? I think it was like Livonia that was in the flea market with just the panelings, and everyone was in a real bad mood that night.
I do. I believe that was the show that had the really, really good Shima and AR Fox versus Ricochet and Rich Swann match.
Right, yeah.
And a Gargano Tozawa match, and then a bunch of junk outside of that.
Yeah, that's what this venue that Glate's running and T-Hawk's hometown is. It looks like it looks like a venue that I'd be very excited to see Michinoku Pro running in Iwate in 1996, if that makes sense.
Okay, and we will be back with those days next week, possibly a tad later, maybe a day later than your usual schedule. We're working on that right now, but we will return with those days next week as we dive into J-Cup 94 and one of the bigger Michinoku Pro shows in history. A small update there. I am looking at this Glate card, and I put this in the Voice of Wrestling Discord a few weeks ago. I posted a photo list of their champions, and it's Kento and Takuma, and it's Nakajima, and it is Ishida as you know, their main champions. It's like, if you were
Issei Onizuka, come on.
He's also there. He's
the second G Rush champion. I mean, come on.
But if you would have shown that photo to me in 2021, I mean, the back of my head would have blown off. I would have been like, oh my God, Glate is the greatest promotion ever. Shima's won again. You know, Dragon Gate must really be in trouble if this is what their primary competition's doing. And I look at this card in Hokkaido, and even Lindemann and Nakajima teaming together against Junji and Soma Watanabe, I mean, I don't want to watch that. There was not a single thing on this show. And it's been this way all year long, ever since that February Korakuen, which I never saw, but I thought at least looked good on paper. I mean, I look at all these cards. There's never anything. There is never anything that I want to watch.
Yeah, and and even though it's like a T-Hawk house show, like in his hometown, you have the fact that like T-Hawk right now is in this new stable with Ryo Itaka and Michiko up top, and you're just going like, oh, this is what this promotion is kind of doing right now? And the answer is yes. And like, they've been building towards Nakajima and Zuchi for like months now, but they're doing a singles tournament because that's what they're doing right now. It's called the G Class, and it's confounding, and it's just background noise for me for this point that I am the sicko who pays $8 a month for.
We were talking about this in the Voice of Wrestling Slack yesterday. I mean, you are, ever since they went beyond the paywall, you're the only person I know that has watched a second of this promotion. Because it's not like, again, it's not like,
hey, Fred Moreland almost got me to cancel my account. Like,
well, Fred's a good man. I would expect nothing less. But even that Cork and show, let me pull up that card real quick, because I wanna remember the match that I'm thinking of. This was in February, 2/22/25, 640 fans in attendance. Like, they did Ishida versus Yamamura in the main event of Korakuen, and they did Lindemann versus Lio Rush and Nakajima versus T-Hawk. I am sure all three of those matches are awesome. Even T-Hawk versus Nakajima, I'm very into the idea of in 2025.
That was, and T-Hawk was the one carrying the weight in that match. Like, I remember that match very visibly, and T-Hawk was great in it.
But there's no part of me that would ever seek that show out. Again, maybe Ishida versus Yamamura, but it's not like anybody's talking about it. It's not like I'm even seeing tweets from, you know, the alleged 640 that were in the building that were like, oh man, hot fighting, what a great main event. There's no conversation about it. And it has become, despite the roster, which again, I mean, it's fucking Katsuhiko Nakajima and Ishida and Yamamura and Kazuma Sakamoto and T-Hawk and Lindemann, you know, whatever you think they're worth, and Kento and Takuma. Like, it's guys that at one point or another I have not only enjoyed watching, but they've been my favorite wrestlers. They've been in that upper echelon. And I could not be bothered to watch this promotion right now. And they've become a 2AW JTO Gambare Pro type promotion, with the difference being that I'm going to go out of my way to watch the Gambare Pro show with Mochizuki Jr.
Sure.
Because I just saw that aired, and I saw one sequence from the match, and it looked incredible. So I'm going to go out of my way to watch that. I can't say the same for any Glade stuff in 2025.
Yeah, I feel like at this point, it's like a philosophical commitment I have, to be quite honest.
I get it. I very much understand being in that mindset. I am all for that. I'm glad somebody's doing it.
Someone of right mind has to be able to stand up and testify, basically. And that's my mindset about this promotion. And also, like, 30% residual OWE while I track them 7 years ago, I still am a little bit pot committed, even though, let me tell you, Kabune looks like shit right now. Like, he's wrestling in a t-shirt, no muscle definition whatsoever anymore. It's really distressing.
That's you know, about what I expected, but that's too bad. I tell you what, though, I'll come back, I guess, in 2 weeks when we talk about Modern Day Dragon Gate again. I'll have a review of this Mochizuki Jr. versus Munetatsu Nakamura from Ganbare Pro Young Ganbare Summit on May 10th, 2025. I see that's on Wrestle Universe right now. I saw one clip of that match. It looked absolutely incredible. I'm excited to see if the full match looked like that. And good on Mochizuki Jr. for taking an indie date. So I'm very curious to see what he looks like in that environment.
Yeah, and especially topical for Mochizuki Jr. as we will get into the May 9th Hopeful Gate show from Cork and Hall and all the big stuff coming out of that. But because we had a couple bigger wrestling world topics we want to touch on first, and I think we'd be kind of remiss. Someone who said generally been around this podcast and has made appearances in both Dragon Gate USA and Michinoku Pro, but Sabu passing away this weekend at 60, one of the Joe and Rich, of course, like, that Joe is gonna have so much to say about this, but one of those guys who just like encompassed the last 40 years of pro wrestling and an innovator that is almost as influential as what we see in modern day pro wrestling as anything else.
I want to talk about Sabu. I want to make sure that we let off with this because it is one of those things where I do feel like everybody in our bubble, no matter what their focus is, you know, if they're an ardent New Japan supporter, they're Dragon Gate people like us, and we obviously have the Dragon Gate USA connection with Sabu that I'll talk about here in just a moment, or if you're a Joshi person or a hardcore AEW person, whatever it is, I feel like everybody's got some sort of connection to Sabu, and it has been really fun over the last few days, you know, since his unfortunate passing, going back and watching matches that, you know, quite frankly, I would have never thought to go back and rewatch, or watching matches for the first time that I had never seen before. I am curious from your perspective, because there is just a slight age gap between us, when the first time you would have saw Sabu was.
Yeah, so with like the age difference, I got to see some of ECW Hardcore TV in real time in the late 90s, like up until the TNN show. So it would have been 98 and 99 my first exposure to him, because DirecTV was not the single monolith of the cable market at one point. There was, when you would get your DirecTV dish, there would be the DirecTV stations, and there would be something called USSB, which had its own carriage things, and they had Sunshine Channel, and Sunshine Channel had Hardcore TV. And when you are a teenager and you are getting into pro wrestling in a more deeper level than you might have as a kid, and especially at my age in the late 90s, like, I was probably too young to be watching ECW in some ways, but also being able to see someone who just completely did, just the first time you see him, and even though it was just like 1998, 1999, we're talking about, case, we're not talking about him coming in initially to ECW or him versus Terry Funk in the barbed wire match. Although I do remember seeing the commercials, because they would still have those commercials on Hardcore TV for those tapes, along with Extreme Warfare 2. So like, that was like my exposure to him at a point. And it was, I feel like it might be more unique for like my age range. And I think Rich and I are basically the same age, like, as of that time. Seeing him then a couple more years into the mystique, rather than like right as when he hit on the scene in a major way in like 1994 and 1995.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting, because I don't think I realized that you went that far back with him. You know, and I come from the vantage point of my introduction to Sabu being when they restarted the ECW brand in 2006 and seeing him on Raw, you know, at a time where he was going toe-to-toe with the Raw main eventers. You know, Sabu was kind of the guy, other than Rob Van Dam, that benefited from that initial ECW nostalgia and ECW surge in that context. And seeing him have the feud, have the matches with John Cena very early on in 2006 when he got signed, to me was a completely mind-blowing thing. And I remember being very young and not understanding the Heyman moniker that was thrown his way of, you know, suicidal, homicidal, genocidal. You know, none of those words outside of maybe homicidal really registered in my brain at that point. But just understanding that it was this idea that that this guy was dangerous, and he was far more dangerous than an Undertaker was or a Batista was or something like that. And just being really, really intrigued by what I saw. And I remember that Christmas. So Christmas 2006, they had the Sabu action figure out by that point. And it was such a big deal to me that I got that. And he was kind of a guy that I went through those early stages where obviously you have the run with him that is essentially, you know, early summer 2006 through Mania 2007 and being very, very into that. And then around that same point, discovering wrestling on the internet, you know, early YouTube, I think early Daily Motion even, and seeing something like Sabu versus Abyss in the barbed wire match in TNA and just going like, oh my God, like this guy is actually insane. And being a 7 or 8 year old that had an infatuation with the idea of barbed wire ropes. And I found myself a little bit more moved than I thought I was going to, because he's a guy that, like I said, I think everybody's got some sort of story. You know, we covered Sabu pretty intensely in our Dragon Gate USA series 5 years ago, the Rewind and Rewatch series, where we went through every Dragon Gate USA show. And Mike, I don't think I'm speaking out of line when I say that nobody this week has shared fond memories of Sabu's Dragon Gate USA run.
Yeah.
Even though I was thinking about this because I was looking at his cage match, and you know, obviously ECW is his primary employer in the 90s. And then in the early 2000s, you know, there's time in TNA and there's time in, you know, whatever the major indies were outside of Ring of Honor at the time. And then you really get the prominent TNA run in 2005, the WWE run 2006 and 2007. He goes back to TNA in 2010. And then he winds up in Dragon Gate USA in the back half of 2011 into the spring of 2012, Mania Weekend. And as crazy as this is, I didn't really realize this, but Dragon Gate USA is the last promotion that booked Sabu consistently and booked him as like a part of the roster more so than like, hey, it's Sabu, let's do a dream death match here. You know, he was an integral part, for better or worse, of the Dragon Gate USA roster. And to my knowledge, they're sort of the last promotion that used him as that more so than just the dream match guy.
Yeah, and as it relates to like Dragon Gate USA, that's obviously through Gabe Sapolsky and his background in ECW. And I feel like that when people go back and can revisit that series, it's not like tonally it made sense in the Dragon Gate USA kind of way. It made sense in the Gabe Sapolsky, this is a guy that Gabe would definitely book. He booked Tommy Dreamer in 2010. Like, he was open to, as a part of his Dragon Gate USA promotion, indulging in those kind of things because of the idea that a Dragon Gate USA fan or someone's buying a ticket for a Dragon Gate USA show, odds are they're of an age that these people have some level of purchase there. But I really think that that's kind of the case, because and I'm just doing this just blankly looking at Sabu's cage match right now, case. So 2012 and 2011 is when he does his Dragon Gate USA and Evolve run. But after that, in 2013, 2014, 2015, he is working for more different promotions than ever. And it's never, and I'm just going to like mouse over some things. Like, the promotion he worked most in 2014 was Big Time Wrestling with 6 matches. So you're absolutely right. It kind of came to a point that I'm not going to pretend to act like that there might not have been some storylines and like Battleground Championship Wrestling and like those kinds of things. But really, in a lot of ways, that last DGUSA run kind of feels like the last somewhat coherent booked part of his career.
Exactly. And, you know, it's one of those things that I remember saying this at the time, where it's a shame the execution on Sabu's behalf wasn't slightly better because I saw the appeal of using him, and contextually he made sense going against, you know, Sabu never really mixed it up with the Dragon Gate USA wrestlers outside of they did a five-way fray that was Pac, Ricochet, Rich Swann, Uha Nation, and Sabu, which in my head I was going to recommend that as being like, oh, this is the one Sabu match from Dragon Gate USA that you should watch. And then I went back and read my notes from 5 years ago. And man, I guess I just remembered that match way more fondly than it was in actuality, because I was not a fan of the match when I looked at my notes. But for the most part, he's wrestling Sami Callihan and Eric Cannon and Pinky Sanchez. And it was one of those things that technically made sense, but never really was any good. And it ends with a very, very long Sabu versus Sami Callihan match at WrestleMania weekend that I think you were in attendance for.
Yes, I was. Yeah. Then, and that was a match that I think famously said that live I walked out and got a drink during.
Yeah. And yeah. On tape all those years later, it was a tough watch. But I did rediscover some Sabu stuff this week that I really liked. It brought back the memory of being so infatuated with the ECW brand when it was brought back in 2006, because, you know, I had no context for what it was.
Oh, sure, yeah.
You know, and to me, as a, you know, a 7 and 8 year old, like something being presented as extreme was like, holy shit, this is incredible. Like, because again, you know, I don't know the difference between anything, but Sabu and CM Punk, and I guess that those are probably the two guys that I was most a fan of, because I've never really been a huge RVD guy.
You weren't a Marcus Corvon guy?
I wasn't a Marcus Corvon guy. I feel like there's somebody else that I was really...
Kevin Thorne?
No, because I don't like vampires. I've never been into that.
And you were like 7. So like, yeah, keep that in context.
I guess maybe it was just Punk and Sabu that I was really into. Because again, like, I tolerated RVD, but I've never really been an RVD guy. But Sabu and Punk, I was very much into. But I remember being so into that brand that I went on eBay and bought the ECW Deep Impact VHS comp, which would have been put out like right before ECW died, and not understanding that the ECW on Sci-Fi.
I must interject here. When did you make this purchase? Like, were you on eBay at like age 7 doing this? I feel like that's an important point of information that needed to be clarified.
Well, because my mother in the mid 2000s was an eBay fiend. And so being brought onto the internet was just a synonym for being brought onto eBay at that point. And because, you know, because all I would do is look for old wrestling action figures and buy, you know, wrestling DVDs with my mom's credit card and things like that. So that was the primary function of eBay at that stage of my life, as odd as that may sound. It was like highspots.com, you know, it was a vehicle to get wrestling memorabilia. And so I bought this ECW comp tape, not knowing what it was, just knowing it was ECW, and not understanding the leap that ECW on Sci-Fi had from a production standpoint to regional indie Eastern Championship Wrestling. And I remember turning that tape on and seeing like Tommy Dreamer and Terry Funk versus like the Sandman and Steve Austin. But it was the ECW era where it was the red, yellow, and blue ropes.
Oh yeah.
And it was the equivalent of staring into a solar eclipse, where you just like, I couldn't look. It was just like, oh God, like, what is this? This looks so bad. I don't like, I like the new ECW, because whatever this is just really, really
sucks. HGTV exists now.
Yeah, like, it's awesome. Like, Paul Lee, you gotta check this out. You should have shot these shows in HD, basically, was kind of my thought. And it wasn't until years later that it was like, oh, okay, I now understand the not only why it looked that bad, but, you know, why aesthetically this is actually quite charming. But, you know, that was all based on Sabu, and then to a lesser degree CM Punk. But he really captured my imagination. And going back and watching, like, I watched the Abyss barbed wire match yesterday, and I was like, oh man, this really is awesome. I watched, because I'm assuming you haven't seen this, I'll give you this recommendation and everybody this recommendation. I watched the Sabu LA Park match from MLW in 2002. Now, they've got two matches. The first one is from like Kings of Coliseum or something. The second one is a Mexican death match. The second match with Sabu in the teal pants is not any good. I watched it today, was super disappointed. But Sabu in the red pants against La Parca LA Park at MLW 2002 was incredible. Have you ever seen this match?
I did not see this match. I saw you post it, and I need to check it out, though, because I have to say, MLW at that time, I was only following from the internet, so I didn't catch it. Yeah.
It's really good, and it's, you know, I mean, it is what it is in the sense of it's Sabu versus, you know, LA Park. It doesn't exactly mirror Eddie Guerrero, Dean Malenko, but Park bleeds buckets in this thing. I mean, it is so violent, and Sabu comes across so well. I watched that for the first time. I really enjoyed that. I watched the Vegas match from 94 between Sabu and Cactus Jack. I really enjoyed that. I had never seen that before. They've got a cage match from that same promotion, I think in early 95, that I'm going to watch. I saw that's on YouTube as well. So it's just, it's enjoyable. I'm quite excited for the flagship this week. I'm going to, I guess, table my Dragon Gate Dead or Alive and Corkin recommendations, because I don't see Rich and Joe getting to those this week. So I will just I will hold off on that DM. I would also recommend, you know, on top of all the matches that people can go back and rewatch, Between the Sheets guys, Bix and Chris Elner, they, on the Patreon feed, they made their F Sabu series free. I don't remember if it's two episodes or three, but if you've never listened to the Between the Sheets Patreon episodes, especially their ECW ones, that is them at their very best. They are so in the bag on those episodes. I specifically enjoy the ECW on TNN series about as much as any podcast series I've ever heard. But the Sabu, the F Sabu series I'm going through right now, I'm just about done with episode one, and it's awesome. It's Bix in his pocket. It's Zellner in his pocket. It's really, really enjoyable. So again, there's been some good to come out of this week in terms of Sabu content, and I would recommend people kind of diving into that if they haven't already.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that at the very least, this is like, for Sabu, like in his passing, like this has been like the time to like seek out like not just like the ECW stuff, but the stuff from outside and see where he kind of touched the wrestling worlds in that way. Case, in another piece of content, you had a new interview go up today with Kyle Fletcher and Sky Blue, head of Beach Break. I got a chance to listen to it before you got done, and I was listening to it through YouTube, and I had to bring up the video to see how gnarly Sky Blue's scar is. That's a piece of work.
Yeah, yes. Originally an interview between myself and Kyle Fletcher. We had a last minute run in with Sky Blue being added to the bill as well, and she turned out to be absolutely delightful. So no problems there. Yeah, her scar, for those that haven't seen it, it's on my Twitter @_inyourcase. You can see the link to that video. It is disgusting. And the fact that she can move around at all and ended up only missing 10 months is incredibly impressive. And it's a really fun conversation with Kyle Fletcher and Sky Blue. You know, a lot of Fletcher stuff, I really tried to get into to his mind of just, you know, he's a guy that I've been very high on for a long time, but I think we've all collectively seen over the last year that the ceiling of Kyle Fletcher has drastically altered. And this was a guy that last year I had at number 15 in my Voices of Wrestling 30 under 30. If he's not going to be my number one this year, he's going to be my number two to Shun Skywalker. And that's an incredible leap. And it's one that I think is a consensus. And so I tried to get into his mind about that and about wrestling Mark Briscoe and why they seem to have such good chemistry. And we talked briefly about CMLL and Atlantis Jr. and his match there. And very good time. So that is out there. And obviously today AEW announced a residency at the Aragon Ballroom here in Chicago, which I live just down the street from. So I will not only be at almost all those shows, at least that's the plan right now, but hopefully some more press there, hopefully another Tony Khan interview in the near future. But yes, thank you to everybody so far who's watched the Kyle Fletcher Sky Blue interview. That was very, very fun.
Yeah, no, it's definitely worth going out of your way to see. Case, I actually was over by a former AEW period piece place, residency venue earlier this week, Case. The esports arena, they need to work on their exterior lighting. It looks really rough. Also, everyone who's getting excited for Y'all In, I am sad to report that it's no longer the CBD Kratom back porch. It is now just the Arlington back porch attached to Globe Life Field.
Wow. Okay. That is huge.
I have to come as the foremost Metroplex based wrestling personality. I have to come with updates to people for that.
You do. No, it's you know, you're just doing your job. You know, don't shoot the messenger.
Yeah, no. Hey, I'm just out here trying to cover my beat. I mean, we just tend our plot of land over here, Case. And with that, we have this incredible Hopeful Gate show that happened at Corcoran Hall on Friday. And in almost like a promotion of two different just tones coming one way out of Dead or Alive. And then the way that Hopeful Gate kind of completely cleansed the palate 4 days later.
Well, that was how we left off last week, was talking about this Dead or Alive show that, admittedly, you know, I think you and I had show of the year expectations going into Dead or Alive that, you know, on paper, we felt like the build and the card had led us to a future where we could have been exiting Dead or Alive saying this is the best show in Japan this year, or this is one of the best shows in Japan this year. And it wasn't that. You know, it was one of those weird shows that wasn't bad, but was deeply unsatisfying. And that's always a tough thing to grapple with, because if you go and look through that card, it's like, well, I liked that match and I liked that match. And, you know, that one over delivered, this one slightly under delivered. But the finish of the show, the last thing that we were left with was just this very odd heel turn that felt forced, that felt cold. We didn't like the execution of it. And we weren't sure what we were going to get in Corkin. Now, I said at the end of my Dead or Alive written review, which is up at voicesofwrestling.com, I said, look, if they stick the landing on May 9th and they find a way to really make sense of this Kakuta heel turn, we could be in for an incredible summer where it feels like all of Dragon Gate's main characters are going to be involved in a real way, and we could be off to the races. It was really going to depend on this May 9th show. This was going to pave the way for the June Corkins, for Kobe World, and then for whatever we see out of there. So there was a lot of pressure and a lot of expectation on this show. And I think what we ended up with was the best Dragon Gate show of the year.
Yeah, it's either going to have to be that or Rey de Parejas, I feel like, the Rey de Parejas finals. But I at least came out of this show with like the direction, and I think it's kind of worth taking that and talking about it in of itself, that this is a promotion that in that they've kind of tipped their hand how they're going to be treating at least Corkin Hall for the upcoming June shows. And I would believe going into the fall, where Corkin Hall will become one of the more dominant venues for them, that we can kind of see a lot of that. It wasn't just that we got like the bad taste of out of our mouth about the Kakuta turn. Now, at least, well, I don't know if it's fully been retroactively kind of settled, but performances there don't have you in any sort of doubt of, oh, is Kakuta going to work as a heel? No, he's going to be amazing. Like, we got to see him and Shun Skywalker really display a kind of edge that is needed. But then you continue down the card and you have the semi-main event that we've been waiting for, that they've been building up, Masaaki Mochizuki versus Johnny Valletta, being another great Johnny Valletta match. And then the heel contra heel match, which is, it's hard for me that I don't know if I ended up liking this match more or the DGUSA April 18th six-man tag more. But it just, in a way, with both that and the post-match stuff coming out of the main event, everything feels like it's all systems go, and not treating Nagoya as like a huge crack in the road that's going to trip you up. You just step over it and just kind of continue, dust yourself off and continue.
No, it worked out great. You know, this was really the best case scenario coming out of this show. And it was not only one where I always say this about Corkin shows, is the key to a Dragon Gate Corkin show is, yes, you have a bunch of great matches or a bunch of hot angles or, you know, stuff that's literally on the show that is enjoyable. But I tend to feel better about this promotion when we have an idea of what's coming in the next month. And now we've got this June double shot where Dragon Gate is pulling a page out of the Pro Wrestling Noah playbook and saying, oh, we should just put a bunch of title matches in Cork, and people seem to like that. It's never been the way that Dragon Gate has done business. I don't anticipate this being a ginormous trend going forward, but the first of two June Corkin shows, the first one of this double shot, you've got a Brave Gate match, a Twin Gate match, and a Dream Gate match. And then the second night, you've got Dragon Kid and El Desperado teaming with one another against a mystery team. We don't know who that is at this point. So it had every single thing that you would want. Again, the Kakuta stuff was excellent. The Valletta stuff was incredibly satisfying. The main event, which feels like there's way more to that story with Hyo. You know, we're going to get more out of that. the undercard was incredibly entertaining. You know, you think about the Yoshioka match and what that accomplished there. You think about the Paradox versus Zebrats match and the continued excellence of undercard wrestler Kagetora, which who would have thought there? You know, you've got Kai and Ishin. I've got more on Kai and Ishin later. The term I used in my review, which again is up at voiceofwrestling.com, it was an efficient show. They did so much in seven matches. It really couldn't have been a better outing following the shaky Dead or Alive show. And all of that could have been true if the main event was just okay. But I think you and I would agree, if you're okay with this verbiage, the main event was the best Dragon Gate match to happen in Japan this year, in terms of Dragon Gate matches in Japan.
Yeah, no, I mean, maybe I'm a little bit still higher on KZ versus Yamato than you are. But
that is unfortunately the match that feels like it did get left in the dust. Where right, I loved it too. I went 4 3/4 on it, but I had this shiny multi-man match in front of me. And I was like, well, this is the one that I'm going to ride, but this is really good stuff.
That's entirely fair. But I do think that this might set a trend case for Dragon Gate and Korkins. And I think that is because basically, after Oda Ward, their biggest venue, unless they announce something else, is going to be Korkin for the rest of the year. So I think that this is going to start a trend. And we also had the news that Gate of Miyane is returning in Korkin Hall. So I think that it's really showing that the company that traditionally, and it's still not going to go far away from this, is so much on the week in, week out touring and then highlighting the a lot of big stories that throughout the loop. I think now that it's the situation with all the larger buildings, no Gate of Destiny and Final Gate being moved to February, I think it's a realistic thing to think about that that Korkin is going to have a higher importance, at least for the rest of the year.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. You know, I would be a little surprised if, you know, September, October, November, let's say, if we're seeing a Korkin that is as stacked as the one we have in June in terms of the title matches. But what I hope comes out of this, what I hope the booking trend is post Kobe World this year, post Dangerous Gate, I guess, because that is still happening, is that, like I talked about last week, you know, I remember the May Korkin from last year really well because they headlined with a Triangle Gate match, and they never headline with Triangle Gate matches anymore. You know, I would like to see that. I would like to see a Twin Gate match headline. I would love to see, obviously, more Dream Gate matches in Korkin. I think it'd be really fun, whether the champion is UT or Mochizuki Jr. or Homare or whoever. You know, if they found the right combination, maybe it involves Dragon Daya, of having a Brave Gate match headline a Korkin Hall show. It's a risky move. It might not pay off, but I think that's the type of thing that would be memorable and fun, and I would like to see them do. Again, you know, this is going to be the interesting thing over the next 6 months is, Mike, you and I know this because, you know, we've covered the promotion for a decade now. We've watched it even longer, but like the beats of Dragon Gate are the same, you know, and it you know, 2 years ago, they were like, okay, we're bringing back Rey de Parejas. That'll give us something to watch in February and March. That was kind of new. And then Gate of Bayside came around, and we had to go out of our way to explain to people, okay, you know, normally the first 4 months are really slow. Now we've got a big show at the end of January. That lull isn't there. And this year it was the same thing. But we're about to approach an entirely new set of booking patterns and an entirely new schedule with no big shows after Dangerous Gate this year. And it's very exciting because we don't know what they're going to do. This is really entering the great unknown. And in Dragon Gate, very rarely are you entering the great unknown.
Right. But I feel like that at least in the way that they've set up these matches, and at least coming out of this Korkin and looking ahead to June, and then they don't have a date yet for Gate of Miyane too, but I would suspect that probably would be towards the fall. It does seem like in a lot of ways you take a show like this one, and even though it was 3 hours and stuff really was going on each and every match, and I would say that at least everything felt like it flowed into each other. Maybe not as much as the stuff from last fall, but you take the show and you still kind of place this back in 2011, and it would feel tonally exactly the same way. I'm interested to see with those 6 months, the great unknown, if you're going to be able to take those Korkins and drop them into 2011 or even really 2016 in a way. Like, I think that's going to be an interesting thing to track.
You know, I think you and I have been very bullish on this promotion this year, and some people might roll their eyes when they hear that. But, you know, historically, you know, it's not like we love everything this promotion does. You know, we've been incredibly critical of the booking, you know, since 2021. And there are years, you know, 2022 was not a year where this was a particularly cheery podcast. But you and I have really enjoyed what they did. And I think this promotion is just going to have some freedom to do some different things this year. And I'm very curious to see if they capitalize on that freedom. And I don't know. I leave this show with, you know, a Mochizuki versus Yamato match staring me down the face, and Kakuta as a heel, and Skywalker still as a heel, and Homari, you know, still being relevant. And now you've got, all of a sudden, you've got this life to Natural Vibes that wasn't there the first 4 months of the year. You've got this intrigue with D-Courage now, with Yoshioka having the shaved head and Die Off and Super Juniors and, you know, whatever they're going to do there. Like, I just left this show fired up. You know, Hyo now being a part of Gold Class, whether it's still going to be Gold Class or they're going to change the branding of it. Like, all this stuff is up in the air, and it feels really exciting. Again, this is the exact type of show that this promotion needed, because we've seen them slide off course. I mean, look, all it takes with this promotion sometimes is one bad show, the vibe gets off, the booking gets cold, the crowd gets cold, and things feel weird for a little bit. And things very easily could feel weird right now if we didn't get the show that we got. And I got to say, I love this show.
Yeah, let's talk about this main event. Hyo contra Hyo, Gold Class versus Natural Vibes. Just one of those matches that the company sends the guys out there, and they go 20 minutes, and before you know it, the finish happens. You go like, oh, Jesus, that just happened. Mochizuki Jr. gets the win for Gold Class with a bridging German suplex after a ferocious, like, last closing stretch where UT got kicked in the head legitimately about a good solid four times. And that just capped off a match where you really got to see endless chemistry and pairings throughout, like, the combinations of Natural Vibes and Gold Class. And you guys see Benkei and KZ do a crazy Benkei sell angle a bit. You really got to see a little bit of everything, and you kind of are left with, oh god. But Mochizuki Jr. a couple months ago, it felt like that he was kind of wading water. Now he's in the best shape of his career, and he is doing, I don't know if this might be a thing that tradition may have done, but it might be the first time that both a father and a son are challenging for different titles in Japanese wrestling history on the same show.
That is, I'm going to have to look into that. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, but now I'm very curious. You know, my big takeaway from this match, outside of just the obvious greatness that ensued, and I want to break it down a little bit more, but I feel a good omen ensuing, given that Mochizuki Jr., like you said, towards the end of the match, he's peppering UT with these mid kicks. It's one kick to the chest, two kicks to the chest, three kicks to the chest. And then UT alters his position, and Jr. legitimately kicks him as hard as humanly possible in the head. And that is such UT's luck, and that is the type of thing that feels like it should have concussed UT. The match would have had an awkward ending. He would have been knocked out. They would have had to go to the pinfall. He would have had to vacate the Bravegate belt. It just feels like in another timeline, that little spot would have spelled disaster for UT and for everybody involved. And he was able to hang on. He hasn't missed any time. We haven't heard anything about him missing any time or him not being healthy. That in itself, Mike, what a ginormous win that is. Because don't you agree that, like, there's another version of this where UT is just on the shelf now for months?
Oh, no, there's a version that UT gets his head possibly kicked off.
Yes.
Like, it's not outside of the realm of possibility with the guy. But it just really, I think with someone like Junior, that just because of the way that the year kind of played out, has been in a back seat role, and then seeing him revitalize with that, and the chemistry that him and UT really showed together in that stretch. I don't know how many more times I want Junior to test his luck with the UT kicking bag, but at least in this closing stretch, it did have like a moment of me that I was like, oh, 2 years ago, UT would have crumpled there and they've waved off the match. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. So that's winning chemistry right there. I can't wait to see what they do in that Bravegate match. You had Kame all over the place, you know, and we did a segment, it feels like probably a year and a half ago now, I don't remember what the exact match was, but we talked about how Kame has the highest ceiling, it feels like, in this promotion, and by proxy has one of the highest ceilings in all of wrestling. And I went back, you know, from August of 2021 to now, and I highlighted some of the best multi-man matches that this promotion has had, and they almost all, I think with the exception of one, which was a Zebrats Gold Class match from last year, they all either feature Kame or they feature KZ, and most of them feature both those guys. And this was another match that jumped out to me. It's why I'm so insistent on, if they go back to America, sending Kame and sending Rita, because those two guys were, to me, two of the three MVPs. And Mike, what is there left to say about Jackie Kame? When he is in a big spot, he always delivers.
He's big match Jack. I mean, and in this kind of performance where he got some really good time with everyone in it, and it just also felt like you had times where, like, oh, him and Flamita got kind of mean with each other, and I was like, oh, I like that. And and then you also see Kame going for stuff of UT, and you're going like, oh no, that's excellent. And you have to stop for a second, you go like, oh, Jackie Kame, whenever he is put in this position, he has the best batting average out of anyone in pro wrestling. Like, I think that you could honestly take him and put him like right in the middle of like the AEW six-man tag last week, and he would just knock it out of the park there. He's just someone that is able in these matches to find brilliance every time he is put in the position to do so.
Yeah, the other fun thing with him is that he's innovating, and this will make me sound like a curmudgeon, but, you know, I don't see a ton of, in terms of like big spots in a six-man tag, I don't see a ton of new stuff, and a lot of the stuff that I do see, I'm not always in love with. But Kame, like, you know, he does that Jackie Chan, you know, sort of chest walk, arm drag spot, but this time around he does a head scissors. Joe Gagne had the gif of it. Like, no one on the planet is doing that. That's the sort of thing that would blow people's mind. It really, this match actually hit me in a way that made me realize, like, man, I knew this already. We've talked about this before, but the average, you know, guy that watches Stardom in New Japan and is very locked in on those promotions, they are not watching Dragon Gate, because some of the stuff that Kame did and some of the stuff that Rita did in this match, it deserved way more of an international spotlight than it got.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing that, like, 3 years from now, someone will pull out in Stardom and they will react like it's the second coming.
One of my big takeaways from this match, actually my biggest, I thought the guy that was the best wrestler in this match, he's somebody that I really lobbied hard for during the SFM 50 voting period last year. I really wanted him on the ballot. I don't know how many people voted for him, but I had him very high in my top 50. And we have to start this process again, where I can only hope that he gets the body of work by the end of the year that convinces people that he's one of the 50 best wrestlers in the world. Because despite a smaller sample size than most, the work that Flamita has done over the last year, ever since he returned in Hokkaido and joined Natural Vibes, I didn't think he still had this motor. I didn't think he still had that agility. I didn't think he was capable of doing all the things that he's doing. And for as great as this match was, the junior stuff, the UT stuff, the KZ stuff, the Ben stuff, the Jackie stuff, the Rita stuff, I don't want to leave Strong Machine J out. He was, you know, maybe the least memorable guy, but he wasn't bad in this match. To me, the star was Flamita. I am absolutely floored by the work that he does when he gets to Japan.
Yeah, and for him, it really, like, as these this tenure has continued, he's been this solidifying force for Natural Vibes at a time where, I mean, just 2 weeks ago, we're like, maybe it's about time to close up shop here. Then Flamita shows up back again, and he's an instant just blast of adrenaline into the promotion. And
if you're somebody that, like, didn't watch Dragon Gate this year until Dead or Alive, because, you know, you just fell off, you got busy, whatever, you're like, oh, Dead or Alive, that's a big show, and then you watch Dead or Alive and you watch this Corkin, you would be going, oh, so it was Natural Vibes, are they just the MVPs of the promotion this year? Like, they're just kind of the best things around. It's like, no, 2 weeks ago we all wanted to kill off this unit because we thought they were dead in the water, and now, I mean, Flamita comes back, like you said, it just completely changes their fortunes.
Yeah, and it's even to a point that, yeah, no, we're not getting Natural Vibes sexy times going forward of Hyo, even though they pandered for him the abject most. Like, Natural Vibes incorporated the big brain dance into their dance number. They were ready to go. But it feels like that they're still in a really good place coming out of this show. And yeah, I still feel like that they're going to need to add another fifth member, but at least the core four, they're in such a good spot, as long as we don't discover that UT secretly got his jaw exploded again by Junior.
Yes. Yeah. So just all in all, an incredible match. Hyo ends up going to gold class. I know there's been some conjecture about, is the gold class branding done? Are they rebranding this unit to say Love and Peace? I don't love that name. I would hope if they rebrand, they go with something else. If they do rebrand, we'll dedicate an extended period of time to sort of going over the history of gold class. But I've become so fond of this mess of a unit. You know, this unit that started with Kota Minoura as basically a silent tweener, a himbo, Naruki Doi and Kota Minoura. And that was 3 years ago, and it might as well have been 30 years ago. And to think about the changes and the peaks and valleys that Gold Class have gone under, they've come out on the other side, and they've come out with Rita and with Kame, and now with Hyo. I've grown so attached to Gold Class that I want them to stick around. What do you think about the branding of them going forward?
I think that bringing in Hyo, and I think Jay did a kind of good job, at least setting the groundwork for this on commentary. He is a 1A. Like, he comes in at a different position now than Rita and even recently when Kamei or Junior joined. Like, I mean, he has ascended to that point where I feel like that this could be the right time to really detach from that imagery. Do I think Love and Peace is kind of the thing for it? I mean, it might play into how Benkei is going to close the shows from now on. Like, that, like, he's hammering that he wants to bring love and peace and happiness to Dragon Gate, but it feels more like something that you say as a tagline for a different unit, right? Like, it's clearly going to be positioned as the super face, and maybe this is the superpowers finally starting to unite to take down an overwhelming Z-Bratz at this point. But I think to do so, it is time to step away from that gold class thing.
Interesting. Again, Love and Peace makes me nervous. I know it's not for a lapsed Rangeet fan. I don't think that name and that likeness is going to get anybody back on board. And I do have to think about that to some degree. But we're now in a position where we've got a unit that is Ben and Hyo, who are clearly chomping at the bit to do something with each other because they've never been in the same unit before, as crazy as that sounds. And then you've got this Junior Rita Kame trio that, again, you know, you're talking about Rita and Kame, one of the best tag teams in the world, Junior just bursting with potential. And if you wanted to put the Triangle Gate belts on them, I think they could be, a world-class trios team. So there's just a lot to like with that combination of guys right now that feels fresh with the inclusion of Hyo. And again, you know, we're only 4 months removed from Kame joining that unit, which freshened them up also. So there's a lot to like with whatever the name of that unit is going to end up being.
I have a crazy prediction I want to make right now that just popped in my head.
Please.
I think Hyo is winning King of Gate this year.
Okay. That is a very good prediction. I have no counter to that.
It just hit my head case, right?
No.
About this new unit and him taking this role. I'm like, oh, it's time for him to win King of Gate.
I mean, let's work under the assumption that they're doing King of Gate when they did it last year. And whether you want to put the belt around the waist of Yamato or you want to put the belt around the waist of Kakuta, and I would lean Yamato no matter what, because until he breaks Shima's record, I'm gonna vie for Yamato to have that title. But those guys headlining a Korakuen show for the Dream Gate, that's kind of what we were talking about. You know, that's got some energy to it. That's the type of thing that it feels like, for lack of a better term, that would be a very dangerous main event for Dangerous Gate or for Gate of Destiny or for Final Gate. Because, it's weird with Hyo. You know, he's the most popular guy on all these shows, but I don't really believe that he would be a big show draw. But him at Korakuen Challenge for the Dream Gate belt? Yeah, that... I'm into that. Him winning King of Gate would make sense this year, given the booking right now.
Yeah, and I think that the big thing that this new gold class has to do is, like, you're right about the younger guys feel like they could be a good component of a Triangle Gate team with the three of them. And unless you're going to go, okay, now Ben and Hio, you've wanted the team for now almost a decade. Congrats, you're off to the races again. And but we're out of like Rey de Pareja season for that. So it just makes sense to me that it's like, okay, this is clearly going to be a unit with both of their leadership. It might be getting a rebrand, but I think the solidifying thing to kind of get Hio to that point of leadership. And yeah, especially with how Corkin is going to now have they'll be running that building as much as they run Sambo Hall really for the rest of the year, that you can do that there. And I feel like that it's a good time for that for him. But yeah, no, I'm really into now how these four or five that now these five guys go forward.
You know, it's funny. I've made the argument before, and I wrote about this in my written review, that I think Kame is drastically underpushed. Given his output, I feel like they should be putting him in even more big spots to succeed. So you have a unit now. And keep this in mind, you know, contextualize this with whatever's going on with D Courage, where, you know, that unit might not be long for the world. If it is, it's certainly going to look different than it did for the first 3 years of its incarnation, of its existence. You've got Ben, who's a bona fide main eventer. You've got Hio, who's right on the cusp of being a guy that I guess could headline any given show. You've got Kame, who they should be pushing more. You've got Junior, who they're going to push more at some point. And then Reach is sort of right in the pocket. Reach is where you got going. If they wanted to drastically shift the tone of this promotion, and they wanted to put the focus as the babyface unit on, and again, I'll just stick with Gold Class for now. If they wanted to put that on Gold Class, it feels like they could do that, and they could do that successfully. Like, that's a lot of star power in one unit.
Yeah, especially at a time where the other babyface units are very depleted, other than Naturalize, because as soon as you bring in Flamita, it instantly gets a lot better.
Man, you've got to really be smart and just run these guys in your Kobe main events, in your Osaka main events, and in your Corkin main events. If it's, again, I'm all about this Rita Kame Jr. trios team, but these guys in 8-mans and these guys in 10-mans, I mean, they could be. What they could do is that they could essentially be a greater version of what Masquerade was in 2021, where, as funny as it is to look back now, this unit with Daya and Jason and, you know, Minoru, who was obviously arguably in better standing then than he is now, and then Skywalker, you know, the thing that we would always bump about it, and you especially more than me, and you were right about this, was Masquerade was a unit full of babyfaces that were pushed hard, that had amazing matches, but ultimately struggled to cross a certain threshold of popularity because they couldn't talk and they didn't have the right level of charisma. This is something that was honest to God said about Shun Skywalker 4 years ago, and it was correct analysis when Mike said it. Gold Class in this position, it feels like they can have all of the matches that Masquerade had, but they've got Ben and Hio and Mascot Rita and then Kamei with whatever he is in the junior. Like, they could be a better version of what Masquerade was.
Yeah, and I think that when you have now clearly the stakes being that who is going to stop Zebrats, you're positioning this unit in a way that when they do this rebrand, I'm of the full belief they're going to keep on trying to get guys, right? So you really have this power to have this super face unit that, although we have had times with like D Courage where they've been the main characters, but that was a different kind of main character unit, right? Like that, even though they were like super face, it was not necessarily everyone waiting for Doi Hoshi to close out the show and laugh and everyone have a good time. That was just more of like they were hot and the storylines were all based around them. Like, this is a unit though that I feel like has that backbone that has not really been there since Maximum, maybe.
Well, and it kind of, you know, it's twofold into what we were talking about last week, where part of the thing with D Courage was you're right, they just happened to have a lot of storylines built around them at the time, but they were so new that they didn't have that cachet. You know, it didn't feel like they were in that position to to be the, you know, for lack of a better term, like the did you enjoy the show promo type team, just because they, you know, they were figuring out how to be main eventers on the fly. And this Gold Class team, they've got guys that can do that. And again, I'm going to talk myself into all of this, and then it's, you know, the July Cork and Show Before World, they're going to do a unit disbands match with Gold Class and Z-Brass, and Gold Class is going to lose. Like, this is just how this works. But as I sit here and talk about this, and I think about, okay, you know, it's funny, right? They announced this show as being like just over 1,000 fans. We know people in the Discord that were there that are saying, wait a minute, they might have actually underreported how many people were in this building. It looked way more like 1,300 or closer to 1,400. Ultimately, they're not selling out these Corkins on the rig. They need something. And man, they have stumbled. I don't know if stumbled is the right word, but they have constructed this unit that just feels like you should just be pouring gas on this unit and watching that flame grow. So we'll see what happens there. Again, a 4.75 star main event to me. Mike, I don't know your star rating for it, but four and a half. You know, Yamato versus KZ certainly in the running. As I look at my match that you're tracking here, you know, Yamato versus KZ, and Homari and Shun versus Jackie and Rita from Kobe would be the other matches I would put in terms of the best Dragon Gate Japan matches this year. But I would have this at number one.
Yeah, real special main event. And that was not the only great match we had on that showcase, because
you had an excellent transition. I apologize. Can I say, I am so sorry to do this to you. I know better, but you were right. I gave you the window and then you started talking and I said, actually, I've got one more thing to say. I just want to point out that it's another KZ match at 4.75 stars. And I don't know what to do with that information. I don't know if there is anything to do with that information, but KZ now, as we sit here in the middle of May, has this match at 4.75, the Yamato match at 4.75, and it was an integral part in the Friday WrestleMania weekend six-man tag that I also have at 4.75. And you know what? 2025 is not any different than 2024 and 2023 and every year going back to 2018 for this guy. So again, I don't know what to do with that. You don't need to respond to that if you don't have anything to say to it, but it's another KZ match that is going to end up being in my top 10 at the end of the year. And that continues to be a trend, and it has been a trend now for the last 8 years. And you may continue with Mochizuki versus Valletta. I'm sorry I cut you off.
Nah. Should we just start like our own Hall of Fame for him?
I don't even know a historical comp form at this point. It's real. Again,
I know it's real attractive to do like the but Ishii thing, but it's a completely different thing because Ishii, like, you have like things on a completely different level and then matches across the world. Like, it's Ishii if Ishii didn't have the avenue to go do it outside of his main company.
Yeah, and like, even like, I mean, Ishii, you know, I don't know, that doesn't, maybe I'm just hung up on the stylistic differences there, that doesn't feel, I see what you're saying. And
I'm just doing pure data.
There's truth in that comparison, but even that doesn't quite feel right, because I mean, Ishii had the Never division built around him and his likeness for a few years when the Never belt really mattered. You know, Ishii versus Ibushi in 2014 for that Never belt felt like a stylistic evolution of wrestling that we hadn't seen before. And KZ's not doing that. He's just silently going out there and churning out better resume. Again, and I like, I really, really like, borderline love Kento Miyahara. KZ has had a better career. I don't, and you and I sound insane to most people for saying that. But on a match-by-match basis, and I think even on a raw talent basis, for as good as Miyahara is, KZ, better career. I don't know what to do with that. I do not know what to do with that.
Man, there are certain things that, like, within the Dragon system that we're just have to be like, oh, yeah. Masaki Mochizuki as well, like one of the greatest wrestlers of this or any era. And we got to see one of his greatest attributes just on display at Cork and Case. Yes, I've managed to figure out two ways to transition to this match. In
absolutely
five minutes.
Incredible. I mean, yeah. My hat's off to you.
And that we got to see, well, we know about Masaki Mochizuki's mind. And that is, I think, one of the most important things about his wrestling abilities, that Masaki Mochizuki is someone who looks at wrestling at a fundamentally deeper level than most people, because why else would you base a match around a whole entire ring style around punching people in the stomach? Well, you take that case and you apply that to the Ricky Dozen of Malta going through and destroying anyone who may qualify for an AARP card. The one man who said, I will stop this monster, was Masaaki Mochizuki. And he said, I'll do it in my hometown in front of my hometown fans. And by God, with a Hurricane Rana out of the claw slam, Masaaki Mochizuki did it once again in another excellent Masaaki Mochizuki match and another Johnny Valletta match, singles match case that I have at 4 stars.
I'm at 3.75. I wrote extensively about this match. I wrote more for this match than I did the main event, even though I obviously like the main event to a larger degree. Look, it's one of my victory laps I'm most proud of here. I saw the Valletta thing very early on.
Oh, this is all you. This is all you. Yeah.
Because you, and look, it's not, you know, not a critique, because you were not alone in this camp, but you were so down on the idea of Valletta when he was first brought in.
Yeah, and I was absolutely wrong. And I've been proven wrong by the end of each of his tour.
It is one of those things where, and I say this about Don Fuji, I think I said this about the Fuji versus Valletta match in particular, you know, the people that enjoy this, that would enjoy this the most, are the people that are never going to watch it, because it's a Dragate match and they're just going to be completely blinded by that and they're never going to see it. And that's a real bummer. But the Valletta stuff as a fan, it reminds me, I always say when I watch a big Mystico match, and when I do the Mystico blurb for SFM50, you know, I say the same thing. Watching a big Mystico match makes me feel like watching wrestling when I was a kid. I just have a level of buy-in and a level of belief and a level of excitement that I don't get from the average wrestler, even the above average wrestler, you know, somebody incredibly skilled. They don't make me feel the way that Mystico does when Mystico's in the ring and he's crushing it on a Friday in Arena Mexico. Valletta has that same feeling, but in a different way, where I'm so sucked in by the character, by the ring entrance, and I'm famously somebody that doesn't care about ring music. I don't really care about entrances. You know, that was always like the level of discourse during a big Wrestle Kingdom show a decade ago, where, you know, people would get mad that there weren't enough unique entrances, or they would get mad at the stage, or they would point out something about Kenny Omega's coat from a video game I've never heard of that I don't understand. But all these things, I never my thing. Not something I care about. But the Valletta entrance with the siren and the chain and the young boys and people running for their lives, and then in the ring, the way that he's been able to be uniquely Gianni Valletta, but also feel like he's working to the standard of a modern Dragon Gate match that you would really, you know, need somebody to have on this roster. Like, it just, it all works, and I get so sucked into this in the same way that, to me, Mystico represents all the good, you know, the good guy technical feelings of that I want out of a wrestler. Valletta is the Rudo, he's the bad guy, and he brings all of that out of me. And I was left floored by this match. I was floored by Valletta's performance. I was floored by Mochizuki's performance. I want to go a little bit more in depth on that in just a second. But, I mean, they've hit a massive home run here. And I don't know if he comes back. They didn't set anything up. I don't know what it would look like if he came back. But if we just get the 3 Dragon Gate tours that Gianni Valletta had, I have no notes. Perfect execution all the way around.
You know what Valletta kind of brings me back to? And this actually plays into what we talked about earlier. He brings me back to a time that I was like 12 years old and I was watching ECW Hardcore TV on satellites and getting up in the middle of the night to pull up the Sunshine Network in a way that, like, whenever, like, ECW was that thing that was kind of the taboo thing that was, it was deep in the recesses of my satellite dish program, but, like, you would see the photos of it in the magazines, and similar to someone like Sabu, there's something uniquely captivating and, like, the raw fear of Johnny Valletta that is just so special, and it brings you back to that time, really, in a special kind of way that it in the same way that I feel like that I would see the photos in the aftermags of, like, Sabu, like, going through a table. I do feel like you could have put Johnny Valletta getting chained up, or chained up at Dead or Alive, or dragging around Koki Oshima by chain, and I feel like it invokes the same level and tone of fear.
I completely agree. You know, that's the beautiful thing about this in Dragon Gate specifically that I don't think would work in other promotions. You know, we talked about this being the initial hurdle of, like, okay, he's doing a Brody inspired act, but this is a fan base that doesn't care about Brody, that doesn't hold Bruiser Brody of 40 or 50 years ago, you know, in reverence. It doesn't really matter. But the nice thing is that once they got the act over to a certain degree, it doesn't feel campy. It doesn't feel like a tribute act. Valletta, within the context of Dragon Gate, works because it feels fully authentic. I would never send Valletta to America because the American fan base, they would go, oh, he's doing the Bruiser Brody thing. I get it. Okay, oh, it's funny. He's got a chain, like whatever. They wouldn't get it. But Valletta, it works. It works with this fan base. It works in Cork and it works in Osaka. And my God, what a match. The second month in a row, we're blessed with accidental blood. And much like the prior month, not only do we get accidental blood, which is always enjoyable, just on the surface, we get it in the perfect match. You know, the main event of this show did not need UT bust open. Would have been cool. Would have enjoyed it. Did not need it. Mochizuki bleeding in this match, objectively, I think, added a ton to it.
Yeah, and especially like how it happened, like immediately after he starts the match with the big boot, the Tope Masaki, and then in that crowd brawl within like the first like time that Johnny is able to get him get back control, Masaki Mochizuki is bleeding profusely, and it's awesome, and it adds to a match that really kind of was Masaki Mochizuki was able to stagger him and was able to keep himself into the fight until he found like the exact right moment for him to get a flash bend. And it just was just beautiful in a way that you in that spot where you first started seeing him bleeding, you then go to a point in a match where it's Masaki Mochizuki working underneath against a super heavyweight wrestler. And it's something that Masaki Mochizuki is uniquely great at in within the company of Dragon Gate, that he is the person that if you're going to go, okay, Johnny versus Rita, that was big, small, and that, and we got that, and that was exactly what it was supposed to be. But when you want to have someone out there to kill a dragon, you're going to send the guy that has killed dragons before. And that is kind of like Masaki Mochizuki's appeal in this match.
So, spot of the match, we've got to talk about this because it's the type of stuff, it goes back to 2018, Mochizuki versus KZ, where they work the gut of KZ throughout the entire match. You have a sequence of moves here. Valletta hits the Iron Claw choke slam from the middle rope, follows up immediately with a King Kong knee drop. He hits both those moves. You would think this is the end of the match. And right before he's able to pin Mochizuki, and it's very subtle. I don't think Jay picked up on it right away. I think he had to kind of use context of watching Mochizuki for 25, 30 years to figure out exactly what happened. But right as Valletta is leaning down to go for the pin, from his back, Mochizuki just hits him with a right-hand jab. Valletta falls to the mat. All of a sudden, we're back even. And it's the type of thing, you know, in the same way that Kame is innovating all of these new exciting junior heavyweight spots that I don't think are really being emulated anywhere. Mochizuki's been a mainstream heavyweight wrestler for 25 years now. No one's doing it like him. You know, no one is doing that spot. No one, I don't think, would be able to execute it the way that he did. Absolutely phenomenal stuff. And it is why I'm so frustrated that he's on the Observer Hall of Fame ballot this year, because he's to me, he's such an obvious yes, it's not worthy of discussion, but I'm going to have that discussion because nobody else gets it.
Right, yeah, because Masaki Mochizuki's the only person who thinks about wrestling in the kind of way to be like, oh, you know what's the right thing to do right here? It is, because he does that short punch all the time. And it is one of like my favorite spots when he does it, because it's always picked at a time where you don't expect it. But then you think back on it and you go like, of course, Masaki Mochizuki is going to be like smart enough to go like, oh, if he hits me with that King Kong knee drop, he takes a minute to pin me. If I can get my wits back, I can get one last shot on it. And I think it's just brilliant kind of pro wrestling that you just don't see from anyone else other than him.
No, there's no one doing that. You know, it kind of, to me, has the same charm as the Samoa Joe nope spot where he walks away on a dive. But Joe, a lot of the time, will use that as a vehicle for comedy, and he'll use it in matches that aren't the most important. Mochizuki does stuff like this in the most important matches of his, you know, of his calendar year. And so it's just, I'm continuously blown away by the guy.
Yeah, and it's something that I think with him, you really get to see him, like when he used it in those stakes, it is kind of in a way like the Masaki Mochizuki limit breaker. It's like, oh, you pushed me to this point. How am I going to get out of the situation? Short punch to the jaw. But it's one of the few times that Johnny Valette has ever been taken down. And it's like, oh, he got him right on the button at the last ditch thing. And it just opened the window for him to get back into the fight and get into that closing stretch.
Ends up being a great closing stretch too. Valletta, you know, at this point, it's not like he's got a wide range of offense. You know, he's kind of spamming the Iron Claw choke slam and the knee drop. And, you know, at one point does an abdominal stretch, which wasn't bad, but it was like awkward in a charming way where Valletta was actually trying to wrestle with this guy. But largely, he's kind of got the two moves. He's got the choke slam, he's got the knee drop, but that's kind of it. And, you know, he's hitting those moves. Mochizuki's got, you know, counters for it at points. At some points, he eats those moves and then ends up choke slam attempt. He turns into the Frankensteiner. Mochizuki, 1-2-3. And Valletta rolls right out of the ring. He grabs his chain. He beats up Young Boys. He walks to the back. We may never see Gianni Valletta again, but all of this perfectly executed, as just like I predicted last week, you know, Mochizuki would win this match and then challenge Yamato. And I will say this, I did not realize they haven't had a singles match since 2017, which is when Mochizuki won the Dreamgate belt into that very lengthy Yamato run. So I was excited about the prospect of this because, hey, some of the best Dreamgate matches of all time, that 2017 match, their match at World 2013, which I think is crazy underrated, than Dead or Alive 2011, I think being the one that everybody enjoys the most. Hey, it's going to be a great match no matter what. Didn't realize it's been 8 years since we've seen them have a singles match. So now I'm even more excited for that.
Yeah, and it's also so tonally right for Masaki Mochizuki to be like, oh yeah, I just did that. And you know what I feel like I can do right now? Yamato, I'm feeling spry. I want you next month for the title. And it just feels like just tonally so appropriate for the guy.
Absolutely. You know, it totally appropriate, but it also, it just made sense. You know, Mochizuki defended the honor of his friends, of his city, of his company. He slayed the giant. Give him a Dreamgate match. This all worked out great. This was all absolutely fantastic. We could see it coming from a mile away, and we got what we thought we were going to get, and that is always good when that happens.
Oh, I am totally with you on that. But yeah, no, did not think that in 2025 I'd have 2 4-star Johnny Valletta singles matches, and I might have another one when I get to the Susumu match from Ikosuka.
The Susumu match is up on the network. I'm very, very glad they put it up there. It's not as good as the Mochizuki match, but it's really worth a watch. It's, you know, it's essentially a YouTube upload. You know, we get what we were asking for, you know, house show footage. This match obviously didn't, you know, the rest of the show didn't make the Dragon Gate Network, but we get this match here, and it's just a blast. You know, it's Susumu and Valletta, and it's what you would think it would be in the complimentary sense of you really get to see Susumu be a master. You get to see Valletta be Valletta, and you'll have the interesting context of watching it after the Mochizuki match. And I think watching the Susumu match, you'll see that it's a dry run for what they did in Korakuen.
Yeah, I can't wait to get to that. We kind of had a dry run of something here in the match before that. I got to stop trying to do transitions. That's tenuous. That's tenuous at best. But Madoka Kakuta, fresh off of the betrayal in Nagoya, teaming with Shun Skywalker against BB Hulk and Yamato. We were thinking that this would be the one that would indicate the next Dream, or I thought this was the one that was going to indicate the next Dreamgate match. But instead, we kind of got reminded of another match from previous this year, and that Shun Skywalker versus Yamato has had, he's had two matches against him in 2025 in Korakuen Hall, and he's absolutely dismantled him in both of them. But this time it was Madoka Kakuta really putting on the hurt here against BB Hulk, getting the win with Hulk doing his spin out burnout paradise 720 bump after the rolling lariat, and one of the most a lot like that January match, one of the most shocking results in recent Dragon Gate memory.
I found it to be absolutely perfect in the way that they went about it. I guess the question coming out is, does this tip off Kakuta versus Yamato for World this year?
I feel like that would be the easy direction. And I think that for now that we really are thinking about the idea that it's not going to be like Shun Skywalker turning face anytime like recently, I think Kakuta versus Yamato makes as much sense as anything.
Do you think it's troubling if they beat Kakuta? I asked Jay this question when we had him on a few weeks ago. I'll ask you the same question now. Is it troubling? Because you got to remember, not only is it beating Kakuta so recently after the heel turn, it would be the second time during this Yamato reign that he's lost, because they had the match at Dangerous Gate last year.
Yeah, and I guess, like, you have the Kobe World factor that has to be kind of regarded, that they'd like to end Kobe World on a good note most years, and it might be too recent to do two bad endings in 3 years if Kakuta wins. So I think Yamato beats him. Does it hurt Kakuta? I do feel like then you really need to look at him for a extended 9 to 12 month period in the Twin Gate division. But with the seal character, and then, hey, if it's like Kakuta and Kato, that seems like that could be a good kind of back burner act. I don't know how much that really ruins his heel turn to lose it there, but I do think that if he loses at Kobe World, you can't have him challenge for a good period of time.
I'd beat him like a fucking drum. You know, he is...
Go do a Twin Towers tag with Yoshiki Kato. Be great. Yeah.
He is a star. He is a main event player, but he does not need to be a 1A right now, and I wouldn't worry about it. Have Yamato choke him out in Kobe World Memorial Hall, and we will continue to be off to the races there. I think that would be such a hot match. I think that'd be such an interesting match because, you know, if they announce, you know, when are the Korkins? June 4th and 5th. So if they announce on June 5th that, you know, in 6 weeks it's Kakuta versus Yamato at World, I think it would be a 50-50 match. You know, I would buy either finish. I think that would be incredibly intriguing. And I would have Yamato beat the kid like a fucking drum. But I'm into it. Again, this match, I mean, it was absolutely perfect. Kakuta nailed his part. Hulk nailed his part. Yamato nailed his part. Shun was there not to do much, but even that worked out. It's, you know, just all in all, phenomenal job by everybody involved.
Yeah, just have Kakuta be a Terminator for the next 10 weeks, basically. Like, yeah. And then Yamato vanquishes the Terminator, and he can go do his tag team with Yoshiki Kato.
I know we've got the stuff with Shun and Himari, which I would never want to lose sight of, and I still want that sort of at the forefront of everybody's mind. But again, you know, this is the first time that Skywalker and Kakuta, in the same way that I talked about, you know, Ben and Hyo, and that might end up being the Twin Gate match of World now that I think about it. Ben and Hyo versus Jason and Minoru, put that in pencil. That feels like that's what could happen. But we've got this Shun Kakuta team. Like, that's... Kakuta can lose at World, and then the next month, if Ben and Hyo win those Twin Gate belts at World, you've got Shun and Kakuta challenging for the Twin Gate belts. Everything's fine. It's all going to be fine with Kakuta. Don't worry about him. Put him in a spot with Yamato. Make him have a second great match with Yamato during this run, and everything will be fine. Results be damned.
What might not be fine is that Shun Skywalker, after the match, stormed back into the ring. A friend of the promotion, Seiji Miyane, was there earlier before Don Fuji's 28th anniversary match. And then Skywalker, of course, pulled him out. And then Miyane pointed out that, hey, when I was involved before, I brought in Great Okan and he beat you. And guess what? There's a lot of people in the wrestling world who want to beat up Shun Skywalker. So
I believe he said, I know somebody in every promotion that hates you, or something along those lines.
So one of those Korkin Hall shows that I think will probably be after Kobe World in July will be Gata Miyane reviving the show of the year kind of in Kobe. In case your t-shirt's going to have more purchase.
This is right. Yeah, this is the shirt I was referencing. I talked about this when we did our Vegas recap, that on Friday, so the day that was Pandemonium Pro and West Coast and Prestige, I wore my Gate of Miyane shirt that was sent to me so graciously by a listener in the Kobe area. And that was the talk of the Dragon Gate crew that day, was how this white boy had this Gate of Miyane shirt, and they were all very curious about it. I wrote this in my written review because I wanted to explain it, because I didn't do a written review for Gate of Miyane last year. We just talked about it on this podcast, but this show is going to be a huge deal. You know, when they did it in Kobe, they sold out Kobe well in advance, and they might have sold out Kobe. This is where my memory fails me. I don't remember if they announced Okan and Bushi when the show sold out. I believe what happened was they announced the show and they announced the main event concurrently. There's a chance that that didn't happen, though, and that show
sounds about right to me, Case.
Yeah, yeah. But there's a chance that the show primarily sold out on Miani's name. They added more seats, and the show still sold out. And Mike, unless I'm misremembering, I mean, even when Drangate was doing their Cork and sellout streak from 2012 to 2018, it's not like we were hearing about Kobe Sambo Hall selling out well in advance the way that that show did last August.
No, this was kind of the biggest success of them doing a lot more focus towards Kobe is since 2021. I mean, they did like the East West show at the Art Center earlier this year. Of course, they did the Rey de Parejas finals and all of Young Dragons Cup this year at Kobe Samba Hall. But the building was not treated that way by previous administrations. But this Gated Miane show last year, at least for my memory, Case, it was the first time that Kobe Sambo Hall has sold out since I was covering the promotion. Like,
yeah,
it's just
not something we ever hear about. At the very least, selling out in advance, you know, maybe on right. a walk-up you get a walk-up, super no vacancy, yeah. but selling out in advance is just not something that I ever remember hearing about. So, that you know, yeah. obviously, much like the SSW Quest, it helped having the New Japan guys on the show, but they've
Seiji Miani is a legitimate name in the Kansai area yeah. as a broadcast personality, so... And he was one that was on a national level, so he still has purchase in Tokyo,
so,
just people are wondering.
So they've got something here, and I'm really curious to see what this show is, and I'm going to be very intrigued by the attendance of this show, if it sells out, how quickly it sells out, who the names are going to be. I'm very, very intrigued by this, but don't sleep on this as like, oh, it's a produce show or whatever. This is a bigger deal than Buyuden. It's a bigger deal than SSW Quest, and SSW Quest felt like a big deal. This is a big show, and you should expect big things from it.
Yeah, and on this Cork, and that already through those top three matches had a lot of stuff to do, we had the 28th anniversary of one of the original students of Ultimo Dragon Gym from the first term, Don Fuji, having his first ever singles match against Ultimo Dragon. In case we should have known, no contest because Ishin and Kai run out as Ultimo and Fuji were legit teasing Asai moonsaults to each other. They restart the match, and we get Ishin and Kai versus Don Fuji and Ultimo Dragon. Ishin wins with a low blow roll up to beat his supposed aunt.
Mike, are you familiar with the industry term known as Windhorst fingers?
Oh, that's about Brian Windhorst doing something about NBA predictions.
He was, I believe he was speculating on an NBA trade. If everybody has seen the GIF by this point of Brian Windhorst, esteemed NBA analyst, you know, sort of calling his shot and doing so in incredibly comical yet accurate fashion, in doing so in the way that he was using his fingers for dramatic effect. I'm going to use Windhorst fingers here, Mike. Stick with me. Who did we talk about turning face last week that we might not expect?
Who were Ishin.
Ishin, who has been a heel now for 5 years. And I think everybody could agree, well, you know, a good heel. Wouldn't hate to see this guy in Paradox, though.
Oh, that would be one Kai.
It'd be Kai. And all of a sudden, we're in this situation where Ishin and Kai, who I believe might have teamed together in the first Rey de Parejas 2 years ago, I forget now, but at the very least, two beefy guys, both, you know, I think everybody would agree, could use a freshening up. Ishin still doing great work, Kai on the back burner, nothing wrong with what they're doing, but, you know, we could see a change of pastures for both of them. All of a sudden, Ishin and Kai have a tag team name, and they're all over this show together, and Kai wasn't involved in the Dead or Alive build, but that was also before Madoka Kakuta was in this unit, before we felt like Z-Bratz was bloated. So the two guys who we feel like need a turn are now all of a sudden attached at the hip. Mike, that doesn't feel like an accident to me, does it?
No, it feels like these city boys might be finding their ways out of the Z-Bratz saloon.
That would be correct. All I'm saying is just make a note of it. In the same way, look, I'm going to make two predictions on the show. Ben K and Hyo, Twin Gate champions, leaving Kobe World. Prediction number two, I don't have a time frame for it. Ishin and Kai getting turned on by ZBrats. They're turning face together. They might not end up with the same unit, but they're turning face together.
Yeah, and I'm going to go Hyo winning King of Gate and getting a December.
That's a good one. I wish I would have thought of that. That is a really good one.
I'm seeing triple Love Hawk on my screen right now, Case, and I have to say this show that looked so exciting did not end up being so exciting up in Hokkaido.
No, I was DMing you saying before we got the attendance total, because you and I about once a week will make fun of Glate in the DMs, and I was like, man,
it's more me like using you as my Glate therapist.
I guess you'll tell me something that happened, and I'll go, well, that sounds awful. I don't really want to see that, but I did give them credit. I said, these T-Hawk homecoming show photos, like it looks pretty packed. I mean, good for them. The show looks wretched, but good for them for at least drawing a house, and then it was 250 people, and I was like, oh, maybe not. They did a really good job of photographing that show.
Yeah, as soon as you look at the hard cam, you see they're using maybe half of an indoor soccer arena, and it's not that indoor soccer arena. It really makes you think. Basically three rows of seats all around. It's just they photographed it real well, and the crowd is going for T-Hawk. Like, that is the case there with it. But, yeah, no, it does really feel like that Kai and Ishin are just in that position where it's an easy off-ramp, and especially the two of them, if they get a little bit too goony, I could see things going the wrong way for them with that as well. We had Paradox versus the rest of ZBrats, Dragon Kid, Kagatora, Nuruki Doi, Susumu Yokosuka, Hamare, Jason Lee, Kota Minora, and Yoshiki Kato. Case, we had our Dreamgate challenge alarm. I think it was like DEFCON 1, to be quite honest. And it was for a good reason, as NotHug will be challenged mentally at that June 4th Korakuen after Naruki Doi and Dragon Kid beat Yoshiki Kato. Not one of the champions, but Yoshiki Kato with the Doi Bowl. And Paradox is back. And then, boy, was this just a fun 8-man tag.
I'll make my thoughts here quick. I thought this was going to lead to Susumu and Kagatora getting the challenge, but by no means would I ever complain about Doi and Dragon Kid having the challenge here. By the way, did you see that Doi hinted at maybe having a freelance 25th anniversary show on Twitter? Because as we're recording this, it's Doi's 25th anniversary.
Yeah, he said he was going to announce something for his anniversary. I didn't see that it was going to be a freelance anniversary show.
I'm speculating there, but end of August is normally when they do the Nara homecoming show for him. I'd be curious to see if they do it later in the year to not interfere with that, because it seems like Dragon Gate would want to get in on that, assuming Doi is game, but just keep an eye out there. Also,
there is no August schedule release outside of Korakuen, Oda Ward, and then Ginky's homecoming on the 21st, which they usually run those two kind of on the same swing. So it looks like the date could be open.
Yes. And then I got to throw this at you because I saw this right before we started recording. DDT, May 17th. This will hit Wrestle Universe on May 20th. DDT's in Osaka, which is always good because I believe the shows are booked by somebody else who has exquisite taste.
It's Matsui. Matsui does those shows. Yeah, Matsui, formerly of Michinoku Pro and Osaka Pro. Yeah.
Yes, it is Yuki Yoshida and Toy, who I think is an excellent, excellent DDT wrestler, will probably be making my 30 under 30 this year. It is those guys in a tag against Magnitude Kishiwada and Naruki Doi.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Also on that show is Harashima and Kazusada Higuchi versus Shuichi Kondo and Shigehiro Irie. So DDT Osaka, good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Irie getting booked on a DDT main show, it has to be Matsui booking it, not the rest of the office.
I'll hit this card again. Main event, Konosuke Takeshita and Yuki Ueno versus Daisuke Sasaki, and Dick Togo. Like, yeah, that's a fun match.
Yeah, I have way too much Yuki Ueno stock. He's not in the list this year, right?
I think he aged out. Let me double check for you here real quick. Yuki, Ueno is hard to spell because I don't. Here it is. He's 29. I don't know when his birthday is, but he's 29 right now.
All right. I'm going to have to relook at my top 10. Okay.
Yeah. All right, yeah. How about that? A little DDT talk. Look, NotHug's going to challenge for the 20-game belts. It's going to be awesome. Fantastic. I hope they lose, and I hope they do Susumu and Kagatora next, and then Ben K and Hyo.
Nope, that makes sense for me. Or, yep, sorry. Match two, the last time that they were teaming, Luis Monte and Hio versus Toru Iwashi and Bandido in one of Toru Iwashi's final Corkin appearances for Dragon Gate. Monte gets the Super Tigre on Bandido in a fun opener. I mean, seeing Bandido and Monte, like, it's fun because Monte is able to do a lot more.
I know we've got to go in a minute, so we don't need this to turn into a full discussion.
Right.
But I watched this match, and it's net positive Iwashi. Mm-hmm. It's Bandido, who I'm very curious about. I'm curious to see how he develops from now until World. And then the other side is Hyo and Monte. And I watched this match, and I thought, how in the world did Big Hug not work? What went wrong? Because those guys were so good together in this match.
And it didn't help that they came out, they did the Big Hug entrance, and they did the hand pose and everything. It's like, oh yeah, no, Big Hug. Yeah, no, great.
I'm playing head games with myself. I'm going, because they're so good as a team in this match, and I'm going, well, who's the third guy in Big Hug? Like, Did I forget?
Things go wrong?
I'm thinking, like, did they stick Yasushi Kanda in the unit? Like, what? Oh no, it was Daddy Kame.
Hey.
Like, what? You know, Kanda's having the best decade of his career, but it's like, oh no, the third guy was Jackie Kame. How did this not work? Like, how did this not print money? I don't understand.
Yeah, this is going to be the one like episode we do like 5 years in the future, that unlike the Overgeneration one where we go like, how did this get made, we're like, oh, this was so bad, we'll be like, geez, this happened, why did it not work? Like,
because,
man.
Hyo's still crazy over Kame, hasn't missed a beat since joining Gold Class, and I personally believe, because again, Monte is going to go home after World, I think they're intentionally phasing out Monte from anything important right now, so that when he comes back, they hit the ground running. But I, until I'm told otherwise, I think it's an intentional play on their part. As of right now, Monte is scheduled to go home and get vacation at home in Mexico post-World. I don't know for how long, but again, when he's not on the following Kobe card, nobody panic, because as of right now, that's the plan. So I think they're intentionally keeping him away from doing anything mainline right now. But it's like, it just doesn't make any sense. Like, these guys are so good. Monte last year in the ring, it was the thing we ended up talking about in November or December, was when I made my first draft for SFM50 last year, I didn't even think about putting Monte on the list. And then I started looking at spreadsheets and you know, thinking about matches that I remember from the year. I was like, wait a minute, Monte had a shit ton of matches that I liked. It, you know, it was weird booking. I hated the way they put the Dreamgate belt on, and this, that, the other thing, but like, he was still awesome, and he was with Hyo and Kame, and it just didn't work, and I will never understand how. Just those three guys doing the bare minimum should have worked.
Yeah, like, this is the thing that we will like find out like something like 15 years from now.
It's just so odd. I was just laughing to myself as Hyo and Monte are flawlessly executing double team moves that 6 months ago they were in a dead on the vine unit that was labeled a huge disappointment. I was like, what did I miss here? How is this not just a grand slam on every single show? I thought it was so funny.
A dead on the vine unit that will probably be ranked as like one of the worst units in Dragon System history.
Yeah.
You
know, again, it's a little bit TBD with Monte. We've got to see where his next step in terms of mainline booking goes. But we have enough evidence 6 months beyond. It's not like it was catastrophic for Kame. It's not like it was catastrophic for Hyo. You know, Hyo was the main event angle of this show. And it was incredibly, you know, intriguing and over to see which unit he was going to go into. Like, it's just a very funny 6 month in a vacuum unit that will ultimately have no historical importance. And the three guys in the unit were fantastic, and the unit just didn't work.
Yeah, yeah. The opener, Daiki Yanagiuchi versus now bald Yuki Yoshioka. It was a little loose until Yuki Yoshioka decided just to forearm him to death, which ruled.
So I've always been in the camp. I think people personally are crazy when they talk about Yoshioka not having charisma. Now, we've talked about this in the Discord before. I think Alan Forel is largely on my side of Yoshioka having charisma, but he's played devil's advocate well. I remember having that conversation with him in the Discord, and like, I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me. He doesn't connect with some people. I will say bald or now buzz cut, because Yoshioka's hair grew out so quick that like, it's a problem. I think they actually need to shave his head again. this I could see. I could see him having a bit of a charisma issue for whatever reason with this new look, but I did like the way they approached this match with him spamming forearms and sort of beating Yanagiuchi into a pulp. And then it was announced after the show that Yanagiuchi is going to retire his Cork and Hall employee gimmick. So expect a new look from him here shortly.
I hope he gets another leg for his pants.
I like his gear. I think that works for him.
I know that there's going to be a deficit of Daiki Yanagiuchi being kind of taken seriously because of his general kind of disposition and like just physical charisma. The gear does not help with that.
I could buy that.
But that was Cork and Hall. There was a advance about, but it was a minute long match with Punch and Managa.
And, like, we said our piece on Kai Nishin already.
Yep, but that was the Cork and Hall show, and Dragon Gate is actually for the promotion is going to be on tour for the next few weeks, but we are not going to actually have any Dragon Gate footage on the network until May 23rd, case. So as we talked about earlier, next week it's going to be time for those days, and it's time for perhaps one of the biggest flashpoints in the overall history of Michinoku Pro, the Super J Cup at first stage.
Yes, we do not have the Hokkaido cards yet. They are in Okinawa this weekend. I'll point out that the Dragon Show has Yamato and Gurken Mask versus Rita and Kame for the Ryukyu Dragon Pro Tag Team Championships. That'll be on YouTube. I'll keep an eye on that. I will let people know if that match is worth watching after I see it. But yes, next week we go back in time, 1994. Great Sasuke, New Japan Pro Wrestling, Super J Cup. Clap, get into it.
And that's going to do it for us this week. You can follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate. Case is on Twitter at _inyourcase. I'm on Twitter at Fujiheya. If you want to join the discussion, step inside the Voices of Wrestling Discord. We have the Dragon Gate channel where we'll be talking probably about these Okinawa shows and waiting to see how the Dawn of Okinawa and Yamato take on those chibis. But also we have the Open the Voice Gate channel where we will post the match listings for all of our other programming, including those days, but also any other updates as it relates to Open the Voice Gate. Just go over there to the Voices of Wrestling Discord. But that's going to do it for us this time. We'll be back with you next week with those days. Take care, everyone.
Hi, I'm Case Lowe, co-host of the Open the Voice Gate podcast. The one question I'm constantly asked when it comes to Dragon Gate is, how do I get into the promotion? Well, stop asking and start listening to the Open the Voice Gate podcast, released every Wednesday on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. For exclusive news and show reviews, look no further than the leader in Dragon Gate coverage, Open the Voice Gate.